Blog Talk Radio.
Overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators, but we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will be the participants in making it so. And so as I leave you this evening, I say, walk together, children. Don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the parliament.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom, Season 11. Voices of Wisdom is so named to keep the voice of Rachel Berry, rest in peace, alive through our platform. She created the group Voices of Wisdom because everyone knows something that someone else needs to know, officially known as the Vow Network on Meta, formerly Facebook. The forthcoming episodes promises to be just as enriching and enlightening as the first 10 seasons that brought you family members from Dr. King to Emmett Till, hosted by the Tuvalu 9 members, Drs. Joseph Jackson Jr. and Geraldine Hollis. It's hard to believe we're still going strong, but that was the promise made by yours truly, me, Beverly Black Johnson, who will be moderating this season. We've been bringing live content and guests with voices that tell of Black history and struggles from sharecropping to freedom marching. Now we will delve deeper with guests who are thorough in knowledge with and about the business of speaking truth to power for our people. Our voices will not be silenced. So please tune in. You can call 515-605-9351, or you can listen in our studio audience, or excuse me, our studio actually, blogtalkradio.com/gumbo for the soul. Voices of Wisdom is aired on Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand created, owned, and operated by yours truly, Beverly Black, all rights reserved. It is an honor that I bring to you today's guest, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey, author of the best-selling book, Freaknik Lawyer, discussing his book, The Duke of 18th and Vine, Bob Kendrick Pitches Negro League Baseball. Harold Michael Harvey is the author of Freaknik Lawyer, a memoir on the craft of resistance. He is a past president of the Gate City Bar Association. He is the recipient of Gate City's R.E. Thomas Civil Rights Award, which he received for his pro bono representation of Black college students arrested during Freaknik celebrations in the mid to late 1990s. An avid public speaker, you can contact him. He will be giving you all of his information. His website is haroldmichaelharvey.com. My website is tribefamilychannel.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I proudly bring to you Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. Hello, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey, three first names. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful today. How about you today?
I'm blessed. It's an honor, privilege, and a pleasure, again, to have you sponsor Putting Voices of Wisdom back on the air. This is our 11th season. We closed off season 10 with the leaders of the Tugulu Nine, and I'm telling you, we have had some real, real voices on here. So bringing your voice here with your background and just your knowledge and prowess is an honor, and I can't wait to delve into the conversation. But now, we agreed that when baseball first became organized in the 1860s, a small handful of African-American players took the diamond alongside their white teammates. But with Jim Crow laws and prevalent segregationist sentiment still left over from the Civil War, the careers of talented African-American ballplayers was short-lived. Now, what prompted you to write your book? Tell us the name of the book and who it is about once again.
Well, the name of the book is The Duke of 18th and Vine, subtitled Bob Kendrick Pitches Negro League Baseball. 18th and Vine is in that entertainment district where all the your great Kansas City, Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, jazz musicians got their start in that entertainment district back in the early 1900s, 1920s, 1930s, before those guys make their way to New York and became stars. You know, they were the stars of 18th and Vine. And on the corner of 18th and Vine today, it has been renovated, and you have both the Jazz Music Hall of Fame and the Negro League Baseball Hall of Fame. So Bob Kendricks is the executive director and president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. He's been it since about, I believe, 2008 or 10 thereabouts. And he's quite a storyteller. So he's an impeccable dresser. He dressed to the nines every time you see him. Every time he goes outside of his door, he's dressed to the teeth. And so I label him, or I tag him as the Duke of 18th and Vine. And, of course, his repertoire is telling the stories of the guys who played in the Negro Leagues back in the days when blacks could no longer play with white ball players in the major leagues. As you introed it, there were a handful of black players who played alongside white players, and somewhere in the 1880s, the baseball owners, white owners of those teams, developed what became known as a gentleman's agreement. And the gentleman's agreement was they would not play black ball players. And so Fleetwood Walker was probably the last black to play in professional white baseball. I think he played his last game probably about 1887. And then, of course, baseball began to develop because back in the 1880s, they actually spelled the name of the game. It was two words. It was base and ball. And, of course, today in the lexicon, baseball is all one word. But the game evolved. It was a white-only endeavor. And in the early 1900s, the forerunners of the Atlanta Braves, a team that played in Boston at the time, the name of the team was the Boston Bean Eaters, they wanted to sign this black kid at Harvard. When you look at this player, William Clarence Matthews, he had grown up in Selma. His dad died at an early age, and he had an older sister who lived in Montgomery. So the mother then, after the father died, the husband died, she moved William and his younger brother to Montgomery so that the sister could help her raise those two boys. And he came on a visit to Montgomery by Booker T. Washington. He came in contact with William Clarence Matthews and asked William's mother if he could take him to Tuskegee with him and he would educate him. And she, of course, gave her consent for him to enroll in the school at Tuskegee. And William was a very bright kid, so the school was getting ready to develop a football team. This is like in 1892. And so the coach of the team was James Washington, the brother of Booker T. Washington. And
wow.
So James gave William Matthews a book on football, told him to read the book and study it. And so William read the book, and then he and James Washington went out and laid out the field that Tuskegee plays on today. It's Alumni Bowl. The field has now been named for one of their most outstanding coaches, Coach Cleve Abbott. But so this youngster read this book, laid out the field, and they organized a football team, and they would play the soldiers from Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. It's about 30 miles from Fort Benning. And so they would play those the soldiers who had a football team back in the early 1890s. The following year, they went a little bit above the on top of the bowl, and they laid out a baseball field, which is now named James Washington Field, that is where Tuskegee began to play baseball. So Matthews was a very good shortstop. When he finished his coursework in 1897 at Tuskegee, Booker T. Washington got him enrolled into the Andover Academy in Maryland, I believe. And with the understanding that when he finished his course study at Andover, he would come back and teach what he had learned in school to other students at Tuskegee. But when he finished his work, his schoolwork at Andover, Harvard came and offered him a four-year scholarship. And then so he goes and he plays baseball at Harvard.
Wait, I want you to stop right there. Stop right there. I hate to stop you. Ladies and gentlemen, these gems that you hear dropping is coming from Mr. Harold Michael Harvey, my guest right here on the 11th premiere season of Voices of Wisdom. His memoir, Freaknik Lawyer, a memoir on the craft of resistance, was due to his pro bono representation of the black college students that were arrested during the Freaknik celebration in the late 1990s. Now, that's a sacrifice in it of itself. For you to do that. But you are dropping so many gems, I have to stop you right there because when you read our history, and when particularly when you read Booker T. Washington's autobiography, you will learn that he sacrificed a lot. And unless you read his book, you cannot possibly understand the measure of his sacrifice. A lot of people think he was whitewashed and understand the way he was suited and his posture and what he attained and how he carried himself. You may think that, but if you read the level and the measure of his sacrifice, I guarantee you'll find a newfound respect for Booker T. Washington. Now, what you said, Harvard offered the very people that Booker T. Washington had a deal with to come back and give back. And one of the things about Tuskegee is that a lot of it is built by the brow and the hands, the sweat of the brow and the hands of those early, early students at the direction of Booker T. Washington. They had a point in time where they didn't have any place to eat, and they dug out. They went underground under the college and dug it out to create a cafeteria. So when you say that baseball field is still there today,
which,
I guarantee you that cafeteria has to still be there today too.
It is, built in 1905.
See?
And you, wow, and I know you knew the history that it was dug out, because when I used to, you could look up it and marvel at the architecture structure of that building. But it was completed in 1905, and it is still in operation, you know, today. And the baseball field, when I played baseball at Tuskegee in the early 1970s, I played on the field that James Washington and William Clarence Matthews laid out, and that field is still in operation and use today.
You know what? That had to be surreal.
exactly. And in fact, the whole Tuskegee experience for me was surreal, because I recognized, even as a young 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kid, that every step I took, I was stepping into the footsteps where someone – but some great African-American had strolled before me.
Come on now. Come on now.
That's the amazing, surreal thing about visiting the Tuskegee, now university, but it was the Institute when I was there. By visiting that campus, every footstep you take, you are stepping in the footstep of someone who has made some major contribution to this world.
Well, let me say this. Sorry to intervene. What I interrupted you for earlier was the fact that when you mentioned Harvard offered the student a deal, see, that circumvented Booker T. Washington. And if you read our history, that was by design. It happened a lot on Booker T. Washington's watch. And he was a man of integrity and a high degree of intellect, a high degree of being able to set his intention, put it in play, and see it to fruition, but for being circumvented in agreement with men that had no integrity. So when you said the gentleman was sent for by Harvard, can you pick up from there?
Okay, yeah. He accepted. But, of course, I think Washington blessed that, but probably still understanding that even after he's educated at Harvard, he would still come back to the Institute and share that with second-generation freed Americans, African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so so what I want to get to the Harvard piece, but I want to say this very quickly about Washington. One of the unique things about his leadership is he went throughout the country identifying where the top talent was. And so he would take a black person. He would go to Harvard and find the black who had graduated from Harvard or from Yale, and he would invite that person to come and join him at Tuskegee to teach what they had learned in the mm-hmm. major white universities in the country, teach that mm-hmm. to black students down in Tuskegee, Alabama. So that was a major thing about him. So 4 years, mm-hmm. this young man played at least 3 years. He played at, I take that back, he was there 4 years. He played at Howard, at Harvard. Now, there was a problem with a player. Georgetown, they would go down. 1 year, Harvard would go down to D.C. and play Georgetown. And in the late 1890s and early 1900s, Georgetown, unlike it is today, was a completely white university. And so they had this white ball player who was born and raised in Selma, Alabama. And the first year that Harvard came down to play Georgetown with William Matthews on the field, the white player from Selma refused to play. And so Georgetown forfeited the game and had to pay the travel expenses for the Harvard team coming down from Cambridge down to the District of Columbia. The following year, Georgetown went up to Cambridge to play their game. And, of course, this kid from Selma, Alabama, refused to play if Harvard had a black player on the field. And they forfeited the game again. So that happened for the following 2 years. So now we're in 1905. Matthews is finishing up his coursework at Harvard. And there began this talk among the ownership of the Boston Bean Eaters, which today that franchise would in the early 1950s move to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and in 1965 it moved to Atlanta, Georgia. So they wanted to, they were watching this kid play up in Cambridge, and they wanted to sign him. So there began talk among the owners of relaxing the gentleman's agreement that said that no club would sign a black player. They were close to doing it. But after school was out, they had not come to terms in early May. So the Boston owners told Matthews, we're still working on it. We're close. I tell you what you do. There's an industrial league up in where is that state that Bernie Sanders is from? Vermont. There's an industrial mm-hmm. league up in Vermont. Go to Vermont and play on a team up there. And in a few weeks, we'll have this thing worked out, and you can come back down to Boston and play baseball. So William goes up, joins a team because he's waiting for the white owners to relax the gentleman's agreement to allow black players mm-hmm. to play professional baseball. Uh-huh. Well, the white kid from Selma, who doesn't have a prospect of playing professional baseball because he's not that good, he decides that he's going to go up to Vermont and play in the league. And when he gets there, he discovers that Matthews is there. And so now, you know, Vermont is sort of, very few blacks live in the region, so whites don't really have this ingrained racial feelings against black people like Southerners do or sub-Southerners mm-hmm. do. So they didn't really have a problem with Matthews playing baseball. But then when this guy comes in, he organized the white players to say that they would not take the field if that was a black player on an opposing team.
Wow.
And
so, well, let me
this
get
is
this
our
straight.
History.
So he comes from the South and brings racism to the North.
Yes.
Okay.
This is our history that
mm-hmm.
very little about history that very few of us know about. Okay, so now the news media has been following Matthews for several months in this early part of 1905. And then they followed him up to Vermont, and now they're beginning to ask him questions about, well, so-and-so says that he's not going to play if you're in the league. You know, before that time, he was getting good press. And the press was that if the major leagues decided to let black players in, William Clarence Matthews is the perfect example of a black to play in the league. And now when you look at his character, I'll tell you what you do. You fast forward to 1947, and you look at Jackie Robinson, and you put them side by side, character-wise, mm-hmm. intellectually-wise, and you've got a carbon copy. You look at Jackie Robinson,
wow.
You've got a carbon copy of William Clarence Matthews.
Strength and humility all at once. That's what I see when I picture Jackie Robinson, is a level of strength and courage. At the same time, you know, it's like that willow tree. He'll bend, but y'all not getting ready to break him out here.
Yeah, break it. Mm-mm. There you go.
You know, you're not breaking Jackie Robinson, and they did not, and he stood. He did not bend. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Hold your breath. We'll be right back on Voices of Wisdom right after this.
This holiday season, show your loved ones how much Black Lives Matter. Give them the gifts that reveal the real history and culture of living black. Give them books that inspire, motivate, and inform. Give the gift of the written words from the Living Now Bronze Medal winner, Harold Michael Harvey. Give them the Harold Michael Harvey Collection, which includes My C.T. Vivian Story, The Duke of 18th and Vine, Freaknik Lawyer, and Justice in the Round. Order some or the entire collection now to ensure delivery before the holidays at HaroldMichaelHarvey.com.
The Negro League's Baseball Museum, NLBM, is the world's only museum dedicated to preserving and celebrating the rich history of African American baseball and its impact on the social advancement of America. The privately funded 501c3 not-for-profit organization was established in 1990 and is in the heart of Kansas City, Missouri's historic 18th and Vine Jazz District. The NLBM operates two blocks from the Paseo YMCA, where Andrew Ruby Foster established the Negro National League in 1920. The NLBM opened its doors to the public in a tiny one-room office space in 1991 with a dream of building a permanent facility that would pay rightful tribute to America's unsung baseball heroes. In November 1997, under the leadership of its late chairman, John Buck O'Neill, that dream became a reality when the NLBM moved into its new 10,000-square-foot home inside a cultural complex known as the Museums at 18th and Vine. Since that time, the NLBM has welcomed more than 2 million visitors and has become one of the most important cultural institutions in the world for its work to give voice to the once-forgotten chapter of baseball and American history. In July of 2006, the NLBM gained national designation from the United States Congress, earning the distinction of being America's National Negro League's Baseball Museum. And again, that museum is run by who we are discussing this evening, my guest, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey, and his book is about. Tell them what your book is about and who it is about again.
The Duke of 18th and Vine, Bob Kendrick, pitches Negro League baseball. And as you just encapsulated, Bob is the director of the museum there. And he's a wonderful storyteller, one of the best storytellers I think that this country and our community has ever produced. And he learned many of these stories from Buck O'Neill, John Buck O'Neill, who played in the Negro Leagues and was the person who was the inspiration behind the need to create and establish a Hall of Fame for at least a national museum for the Negro Leagues. Now, the story that I've been telling you is what baseball was like for black players before 1920. And let me just quickly get from 1905 of what happened with Matthews up to 1920. So what happens is that when the news media began to hound Matthews and they changed their coverage from being very positive coverage to now beginning to agitate him to see if they could disturb him, knock him off his rocker. They asked him if he thought that he was good enough to play with white ball players. And Matthew's response in 1905 was that a black man is just as good as a white man. And that was probably the worst thing he could have said to a group of white reporters in 1905. So, I mean, the good press goes south, right?
Okay.
And so they're hounding him, and so the baseball owners now are backing up because they thought they had this docile guy who would do like Jackie Robinson eventually did and not fight back for a year or two. But he showed them, he said that they were, you know, there's no difference in people. You know, we're ball players. They're ball players with white skins and they're baseball players with black skin. And neither is better than the other.
Sorry for cutting you off, but you know my history keeps interrupting. The crime here is putting himself on an equal level with white people. That's the crime.
That's the crime.
So they're all taken aback. I'm surprised some of them didn't pass out because that you did not do that then, but you had the brave soldiers, like those who you stood on at Tuskegee, come on, that spoke up. You see, that leveled the playing field. I'm not fearing any man.
And that is the sense that you get at Tuskegee, and that's what you leave that campus and go out into the world with, is that because you know that you have been taught, you have been given instructions that other people of other skin colors are given in other parts of the country, so you know you can stack up with them. So he decided, since the owners were taking their own good time to make a decision, he said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go to law school. So William Clarence Matthews enrolled into the law school at I think Boston College, Boston University. And he becomes a lawyer. When he gets out of law school, about 100 years ago, in 1920, the U.S. government is in the process of trying to deport Marcus Garvey. And Garvey hires William Clarence Matthews to represent him.
Hush up.
Garvey's lawyer.
Lord, have mercy. Wow.
Garvey is deported. A few years later, Hoover, the president, he was the guy from Vermont, Herbert Hoover becomes president. And Hoover, let me take it back. It's the guy who succeeded Hoover, who came before Hoover. It is Hoover was from Vermont. So Hoover becomes president. He met Hoover when he was up in Vermont to play baseball. Hoover hires him to be the senior deputy attorney general in the Justice Department in the early 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
He served in that capacity. So, I mean, we know Eric Holder, right, was the attorney general in the 21st century. But 100 years before Barack Obama appoints him as the United States Attorney General, William Clarence Matthews was the second person in charge in the Justice Department 100 years ago, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they did is when the unions were beginning to organize and you had these union strikes and you had a lot of violence associated with union organizations back in that day, the Justice Department would send William Clarence Matthews to those hot spots to negotiate those settlements and union disputes, railroad disputes, coal miners' disputes, all kinds of impasses that were sort of like bringing the economy of a country to a halt because workers were not willing to go in and work for what the companies were willing to pay and for the safety methods or arrangements that the companies were willing to use to protect their workers. And so Matthews would go in there and negotiate the cessation of that work stoppage, which kept the economy of the country rocking. He died at an early age. Never looked at baseball again. So now let's move down to 1920. You've got black people playing baseball throughout the early 1900s, before 1920. Rube Foster was running numbers and God only knows whatever else in Chicago. Got to know the son-in-law of the guy of Comiskey, the guy who owned the Chicago White Sox, and so he had a team in Chicago that he called the Chicago American Giants, and he would schedule games in Comiskey Park on Sundays in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. Whites did not play baseball on Sundays. So professional baseball was not played on Sundays. Those ballparks was open. So Foster cut a deal with the son-in-law of Mr. Comiskey, who owned the Chicago White Sox, where he would allow his team to come in there and play somebody on a Sunday. And he would bring in 50,000 folks and fill the stands. Now, the White Sox would probably be good if they had 5,000 people in there for one of their games. And so on a Sunday, he was pulling that in. By 1920, he called a meeting, February the 12th, 1920, in at the Passaic YMCA. He had in his breast pocket the corporate papers for a league. He didn't call his league the Negro League. He called his league the United States Baseball League. And the reason he called it United States Baseball League is that he was placing Major League Baseball on notice that there was a new kid in town. And they were going to compete with Major League Baseball for the entertainment dollars of the American public, both black and white. So he didn't. So now this is the approach. So the approach that the Negro League brings to the civil rights movement is that we are not your inferior. We are equal with you. We are the black version of what you guys do on the white side. Because you got all white people over here, we got all black over here, and we're just the black version of what you guys are doing, and we are just as good as you are. And I've got this business model that's going to take money out of your pockets because we can put more people in the stands in your ballpark.
Well, that's where it went wrong. let me interject there for a minute. You know, throughout time, here are people always presenting the olive branch, always making sure that we explain that we're not here to become combative with you. We can do what you do, and sometimes better, and you just have to contend with that. But unfortunately, and we're still seeing it play out right now because it is a matter of ego, competence, or lack of competence and confidence in a majority and a minority, being able to cohabit a planet. So we're going to take a quick break. We're on Voices of Wisdom. We'll be right back. I am Beverly Black. I am the host of Voices of Wisdom, so named to keep the voice of Rachel Berry, rest in peace, alive through our platform. She created the group Voices of Wisdom on Meta, formerly Facebook, because everyone knows something that someone else needs to know, officially known as the Vow Network. We will be right back after these words.
This holiday season, show your loved ones how much Black lives matter. Give them the gifts that reveal the real history and culture of living Black. Give them books that inspire, motivate, and inform. Give the gift of the written words from the Living Now Bronze Medal winner, Harold Michael Harvey. Give them the Harold Michael Harvey Collection, which includes My C.T. Vivian Story, The Duke of 18th and Vine, Freaknik Lawyer, and Justice in the Round. Order some or the entire collection now to ensure delivery before the holidays at HaroldMichaelHarvey.com.
Be sure to get that pack of knowledge from our guest, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. I'm definitely going to get mine. Now, we only have a little bit of time left. We're not in a hurry, but I want to squeeze something in before I let you pick up where you were. I want to mention that the Negro League's only female pitcher was Mamie Johnson. When you think about players who pioneered the concept of a two-way player, Babe Ruth probably comes to mind. But another name that should be equally prominent for many barrier-breaking reasons is Mamie Johnson. Johnson was the first woman to pitch in the Negro League and was a two-way player, too. Her career came at the tail end of the Negro League's existence, beginning after the Negro National League had already disbanded. She pitched for the Indianapolis Clowns from 1953 to 55. She had initially attempted to try out for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, but was barred due to race. We'll never know what Johnson could have done playing in the majors or with more time playing professionally elsewhere, but her legend lives on through stories, photos, stats, and accolades. Here are some key points to know about Johnson. Her nickname was Peanut due to her small size, just 5 feet and 3 inches tall during her playing days. According to legend Hank Ballas, an opposing Negro League hitter once asked her how she expected to strike anyone out given that she was no bigger than a peanut. "I struck him out and the name stuck," Johnson said in a moment in 2015. Johnson was one of just three women to play in the Negro Leagues, but she was the only one who pitched. She believed to have compiled a 33-8 record on the mound in her three seasons pitching for the Clowns. As noted above, though she hit two, the reports vary, but all placed her within the range of 260 to 285 for her career batting average. Johnson's path to professional baseball went through the sandlot. While playing on the sandlot, Dish Tyson, a former Negro Leagues player, saw her play and suggested that she had the talent to go pro. That led to a tryout with Clowns manager Bunny Downs, and she joined the team a day later. Later in life, she credited the rejection from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League as a positive and something that helped turn her into a barrier breaker. So all is not bad when someone rejects you. That is a turning point in your destiny. Now, Bob Kendrick, who my guest this evening is discussing about in his book, what Bob Kendrick had to say about Mamie Johnson, hers is a story of hope, a story of perseverance, and an example of how to overcome adversity and achieve your dreams. Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. And you're tuned in to Voices of Wisdom. I'm Beverly Black with my guest, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. Please tell us the name of your book that we are discussing once again.
The Duke of 18th and Vine, Bob Kendrick Pitches Negro League Baseball. Another noteworthy thing about Tina Johnson is that she actually, the reason she got the tryout is because the Boston Braves had signed Hank Aaron out of Mobile, Alabama. And
no,
so Henry Aaron played second base for the Indianapolis Clowns, and they needed a second baseman. And Peanut Johnson tried out for that position, and she actually played second base as the other position that she played in the field. And she took the roster spot that was vacated when the Boston Braves signed Hank Aaron. Of course, by the time Hank makes it to the majors, the Braves had moved to Milwaukee, and he never played in Boston, only played in Milwaukee and Atlanta.
Wow.
Getting back to the Rue Foster point, you are exactly correct. So Foster set out to I don't know if any of your listeners are old enough to remember when the American Football League was competing to be considered on par with the National Football League. And so in the late 1960s, when the New York Jets, I believe in 65 or 6, signed Joe Namath out of the University of Alabama as their quarterback, and they paid him like $400,000, which was an incredible amount of money for a athlete at that point in time. It eventually brought about the merger of the NFL and the AFL. So those two leagues merged and became one league, but the American Football League started playing ball, I believe, in 1959 or 1960, and by 1967, they had worked out a deal where they were playing these annual Super Bowls, the first few, and then they joined and merged as one league. That was Rube Foster's, Andrew Foster's goal was to create a league that would cause the owners of the other league to merge with his, and, you know, they all would make a lot of money. But one day he had taken his team to Indianapolis to play against the Clowns, and there was a particular rooming house where he stayed and where his team stayed when they were in Indianapolis. He was in a bathtub, and there was an explosion in his room. And they rushed in, and Rube is unconscious. He eventually regains consciousness, but was never the same. Ended up in a mental institution for several years, and may not have been in there when he died. But he died. I think the explosion happened in 27. He found the league in 1920. I think the explosion happened in 26, and by 1930. He was dead. And, of course, he ruled that league. He was a tyrant. So nobody knew contractually, you know, how the league was making money. And so that league eventually
closed
it. And in 1935, I believe it is, a group met in Atlanta, and they formed what became the Southern Negro League. Included teams in Atlanta and Birmingham and so forth. And so that is sort of like the history of the league. But
yeah.
when you talk to the players, they have no regrets of not having had the opportunity to play against the white ball players, because when they did play them in exhibition games, you know, during the off season, they were always beating them. So they knew that they could compete against the top players in the other league. And their goal was to ride through this integration. So you follow Negro League baseball, and you can see the twists and turns of the civil rights movement as it begins to form in the late 30s, early 40s, and then by the early 1950s, by the time that Jackie Robinson signs in 47, you know, Martin King is still over at Morehouse. But in the early 50s, mid-50s, he's in Montgomery, and we have the Montgomery bus boycott, which followed 2 years before. In 1954, we get the first Brown versus the Board of Education case, May 17, 1954. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Plessy versus Ferguson case that was decided in 1895 that said that you could have separate facilities as long as they was equal. And, you know, the facilities were always separate but never equal.
Never
and the
equal,
Supreme Court
always
19...
filthy and subpar.
Yeah, because they didn't put any money, any work into them. But in 1954, Supreme Court struck that down. And, of course, in 1955, few people noted, but the court in May 18th of 1955, they issued a second opinion. And some language from that we may be familiar with, that is all deliberate speed. So when things did change immediately after the 1954 ruling, Supreme Court came back the next year and said, you have to do this with all deliberate speed. And in terms of the integration of schools in my hometown, it didn't happen until 1965 when I did it, 10 years after the court said you must deal with all deliberate speed. But I guess
wow.
In the South that meant you had a decade to do it. So if you try.
Well, we are almost out of town, but when you talk about deliberate speed, there is a term that is riddled throughout our Black history. Ladies and gentlemen, if you take the time, if you haven't and don't already, to read, there are so many books that will convey exactly what Mr. Harvey is talking about, how the civil rights movement is threaded throughout the advances of our people in baseball, sports, arts, entertainment, even with spoken word performances, Langston Hughes, and just all throughout every element of life, you will find the travails of breaking down the barriers of racism and Jim Crowism and the likes. So we are out of time, but I just really want to thank you for being my guest and really dropping all of these nuggets of history and knowledge and just keeping the message moving forward. Without us having shows like this, griots like you bringing the knowledge and the wherewithal, having experience, like you said, yourself, when you walk through Tuskegee, you can feel that you're walking in their footsteps. I knew it had to feel surreal because we are standing on the shoulders of our forefathers and mothers, and we are the survivors of the ones that made it. We come from a rich history of people that were captured, enslaved, and brought here. We are the survivors of the best of the best. And guess what? Some of us were already here. Don't get it twisted when they tell you, go back where you came from. You are home, okay? So, Mr. Harvey, I want to thank you for being my guest. I want to afford you the opportunity for any final words that you may have in finishing any points that may be left unspoken. You're on Voices of Wisdom, and we appreciate your knowledge and your speaking truth to power. Our voices will not be silenced. Any final words?
Just simply, I started with this story about William Clarence Matthews, because he did not play in the Negro League, but I thought it was important to note his contribution to the game. And so I actually dedicate the Duke of 18th and Vine to William Clarence Matthews, because I believe that had he been given the opportunity, he would have broken the color barrier in baseball in 1905. Who knows what would have happened. We know that Jackie changed America in 1947 when he stepped on that field at Ebbets Field and played that first game in Major League Baseball. So those changes could have occurred, you know, in 1905 had William Clarence Matthews been able to sign that contract and play for the Boston Beaneaters. So that is why there was some method to my madness. I wanted to tell the listeners what baseball was like for this young man before the establishment of the Negro Leagues, or as Rube Foster called it, United States Baseball League. And there's a reason he didn't put a color on it. There's a reason he didn't put – now, some teams that was formed put colors on their names. For instance, there was a team called the New York Black Yankees. A team in Birmingham was called the Birmingham Black Barons, because the professional team that played out of Birmingham was called the Birmingham Barons. So when they organized a black team, they called them the Birmingham Black Barons. But Rube Foster did not want to put a color or racial connotation on his league. He wanted a league that would compete against the other league, and if fate would have it, they would dominate that other league and bring them to the bargaining table so he could cut a business deal with them. And that's the spirit. And it is believed that the explosion that took place was actually not by accident, but one to eliminate him, because he was such a he was actually taking money away from white baseball owners in that day. So that's my final word for you. But read other books, but also read mine, because it is packed full of your history and really tells it in such a positive light that you have no reason to go throughout life not believing you can accomplish or achieve anything that you set your mind to.
Amen. Amen to that. Your work sounds absolutely fascinating, and I do want to thank you for the sacrifice of putting out the books and conveying the messages. Thank you for sponsoring our 11th season of Voices of Wisdom. And for those that want to know who Rachel Berry is that I keep speaking of, when I first started Gumbo for the Soul Radio, Sister Rachel Berry reached out to me from Virginia Beach to interview me on her show. She is also known as author Lady Serenity. I obliged to the interview, and we never stopped talking. That was in 2011. In 2013, God called her home. Actually, in 2009, we started the show. In 2011, God called her home. Not before I started Tribe Family Channel, so I had to go off the air, but had it not been for Rachel Berry, I never would be on the air today, and Voices of Wisdom was her platform, so there was no other way that I could come back on the air without acknowledging her, because I wouldn't be here. So that is the Voices of Wisdom. I want to thank you, Mr. Harvey, for, again, the premiere of season 11 and your sponsorship. I hope everyone will go out and get your books, and we will be talking soon. Happy Thanksgiving to your family, and happy anniversary to you and Mrs. Harvey. I understand you just celebrated an anniversary. So salute to you and your queen. We wish you continued blessings and have an amazing Thanksgiving. You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you
so much. You take care, too. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you can reach my guest at haroldmichaelharvey.com. Grammatically correct, just like I said it, haroldmichaelharvey.com. Be sure to get his book. That sounds like a phenomenal pack of reading literature for your pleasure. I want to thank you for tuning in. You can visit us at tribefamilychannel.com, at tribefamilyus on Twitter. And I want to let you know that this Friday we have Kathy Wright Lewis, our guest on A Book Is Born. Kathy Wright Lewis will be our guest on A Book Is Born. Other than that, have an amazing and blessed holiday. God bless those that are no longer with us. We're losing more and more by the day. But we are in some trying times, and we have a lot to be thankful for. So if we are still here and you're in the sound of my voice, I'm wishing you and yours happy holidays always. God bless and good night.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges, because they haven't committed themselves to that over that. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I don't think any of us can be satisfied in the United States until that war is brought to an honorable end and American soldiers are brought back here to the United States.
One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. And it seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not.
Tri-Family Channel, oh, Voices of Wisdom.